Rodeo Rodney and his Ropin' Ridin' Rangers of the Radio Range provide the exciting theme music today for Indie Week. Woohoo! It's brought to our blind and print-impaired listeners by the North Carolina Reading Service, and it's read this week by straight-shooting, rootin' tootin' John Federson for the week of August the 16th, 2023. So seated around a cozy campfire here in Studio C, I can hear your questions, buckaroos. What's with all the wild and woolly western weffwences this week, huh? Well, it's a long, twisted tale, but I'll just say we have our reasons. Well, maybe, folks, it's because the opening article here is continued from a week ago's issue, and it's titled Chaos in the Bull Ring, and it's about Durham and the city council. Matt Hartman wrote it, and it starts, Leo Williams leaned back in his chair, a hand over his eyes. Jillian Johnson, his colleague on the Durham City Council, had just introduced a resolution to censure their colleague, Monique Holsey-Hyman, over allegations that she improperly used city staff time to work on her fall election campaign. Johnson said near the end of a contentious March 23rd work session, we didn't really discuss who was going to introduce it, so I'll step up and do it. The move came after Mayor Elaine O'Neill read a letter revealing allegations of corruption against an unnamed council member, identified also as Holsey-Hyman, 4 days later, at the beginning of the meeting. All the council members seemed tired. Maybe they were worn down following the shooting of three teenagers the day before. Maybe it was the brewing debate over the controversial SCAD proposal. But no one, current mayoral candidate Williams included, was having an easy time. James Chavis, a public speaker, said to the council from the chamber's floor, as you disrespect us, we have a right to come up here and disrespect you as well. It wasn't the only comment in that vein from the public. Holsey-Hyman, on the verge of tears, defended her record. Williams said he was confused about whether they were debating the facts of the case against Holsey-Hyman or just the resolution to censure her. O'Neill spoke like a stern parent, chastising an unnamed council member for allegedly using her signature without permission. A reference to Johnson that foreshadowed a preoccupation from the mayor that would reemerge in the summer. Johnson said later that she had merely included a blank line for O'Neill to sign if the resolution passed. Councilmember Didiana Freeman, also a mayoral candidate, and Mayor Pro Tem Mark Anthony Middleton exchanged barbs, with Freeman saying she was, quote, angry and disgusted. She blamed sexism for the way her colleagues dismissed Holsey-Hyman's explanations. Middleton retorted, as one of the two men on this board, what? What does that even mean? Giving Freeman an exaggerated side eye. Stop being a bully, Freeman replied off mic. Then came the real fireworks. WRAL cameras caught audio of Freeman launching a profanity-laced verbal tirade at Middleton after the meeting adjourned. Two eyewitnesses told Indy that Freeman also took a swing at him, missed, and hit Williams and O'Neill, though a local pastor said no punches were thrown. The day's embarrassing events are the most dramatic evidence of the tension, conflict, personal disdain, and conspiracy theories that have been roiling Durham politics for at least the past 4 years. Amid a world historic pandemic and a national racial reckoning, O'Neill, Williams, Middleton, and Freeman won their elections in 2021 with broad public support to shift Durham's response to a spike in murders and an ever-deepening housing crisis. Less than 2 years later, community trust is in tatters and confidence in the council is flailing. Despite marquee achievements like expanding an unarmed first response team and introducing a $10 million fund to improve Fayetteville Street, this council's tenure is best known for scandal. Durham politics has become a morass of bitterness and resentment. Policy discussions are rancorous. Government staff are often left confused, and much of the voting public seems disoriented and dispirited. Many worry the results will harm the city's reputation, give investors second thoughts, and scare away potential public servants. Charlie Reese, former council member, tweeted about the environment in March, "You couldn't pay me enough to run for office right now." Williams tells the Indy, "I'm going to go public about seeking therapy because I saw what it did to me as a person. I saw what it did to me and my family." As the city heads into municipal elections this fall, the Indy is launching a four-part investigation into what brought Durham to this point, how it's impacting local government response to the pressing issues of crime and gentrification, and what comes next. How it began. O'Neill's late 2020 announcement that she would run for mayor was meant to be a unifier in an increasingly fractured Bull City. One campaign slogan went, "Durham for everyone, united, not divided. Grab hands, let's move forward into a bold and bright future for all of us." So long, the maligned bronze medalist of the Triangle, Durham, spent decades trying to attract new capital and investment. For much of former Mayor Bill Bell's long tenure, the city's urban center was the focus. Bell says in the conference room of UDI Community Development, a nonprofit he still runs, "We had to build up confidence in the community." Sepia-toned photos of the company's long history cover the walls, and a tube TV plays the news from its mounted place in the corner of the room. He says, "We could do something in a positive way, and the biggest showcase for me was, what could you do in downtown?" By the time Bell stepped down in 2017, the effort had largely succeeded. The foundations for Durham's tallest building, One City Center, were being laid. When it opened in 2018, construction cranes simply moved across the skyline to new projects. But for many in the predominantly black and brown neighborhoods surrounding downtown, the changes were more threat than success. The pandemic decimated jobs and support networks. Violent crime rose, incomes fell, and many wondered if they would still have a place in the new Durham. Cameron Smith, co-founder and executive director of Old East Durham's Communities in Partnership, says there's quite a few people in city government that really want the problem to disappear, which was the materially poor black and brown people that are embarrassing them and making their lives difficult. Though the downtown-centric approach started under the moderate Bell, who is black, its success became particularly visible under the progressive councils that succeeded, starting in 2017, led by Mayor Steve Shewell, who is white. Many critics placed the blame squarely on the progressives. Smith points to research by former NC Central business professor and current U.S. Department of Energy official Henry McCoy showing that racial disparities are higher in blue counties than red ones. Smith says, "Right now, Durham is nothing close to what it says it is in terms of a city that thinks highly progressively, where we want a lot of diversity, a lot of different ways of being, a lot of different thoughts. I don't think that's who we are, to be honest with you." That racial divide began to sour local politics as the city went into the 2019 election. Javiera Caballero became the first Hispanic council member in Durham's history when she was appointed the year before, but the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People, DCABP, one of the city's oldest political organizations, objected to the fact that Shewell had, quote, expressed a preference for the appointment of a Hispanic or Latino applicant. Caballero solidified a progressive council majority alongside Shewell, Johnson, and Reese, who often voted together for their shared priorities. But many of Durham's most prominent black activists, though often not exclusively moderates connected with the DCABP, saw their votes not as a democratically endorsed mandate from voters, but as an elitist bloc that cut out the people already excluded from Durham's prosperity. When Caballero, Johnson, and Reese ran together in 2019 as the Bull City Together slate, opposition intensified, and Johnson became a particular target of criticism. Ashley Kennedy, a tenant leader at McDougal Terrace, referring to the time in 2019 when the Durham Housing Authority complex was evacuated due to carbon monoxide poisoning, says, "When we went through that whole crisis, we never saw Jillian. She hasn't been around. She's not been seen. That's my biggest issue with her. She's not in the community at all." Johnson, in response, says no matter what one does as a public official, it's impossible to avoid criticism from opponents. She says, if you show up, they call you an opportunist. If you don't, they say you're disconnected from the community. Still, there's plenty of criticism to go around. Former council member Jackie Wagstaff comments, when this block came together, the unfortunate part about it, in my belief, from the people I talked to, is that they were only going to be accommodating of a certain segment of the population of Durham, and that would most likely be people that agreed with them. The other people, you're on your own. The distrust grew so large that the year's now infamous People's Alliance, PA, endorsement meeting launched a fight about whether someone used a Nazi slogan. The People's Alliance, a four decades old grassroots political organization, is also one of the city's most influential PACs. In the end, the progressives won the endorsements and the election, competing a decade in which only a single municipal candidate endorsed by the historically white PA lost. Though the progressives passed major pieces of ambitious popular legislation aiming to combat the inequalities plaguing Durham, including shepherding a $95 million housing bond, at that time the largest housing bond in North Carolina history, through a public referendum in 2019 and launching the Department of Community Safety 2 years later, the racial battle lines became entrenched. Latino filmmaker and activist Rodrigo Dorfman played a central role in the endorsement meeting brouhaha, and he says, something was lost in that election cycle that took a long time to build. Some criticisms of Johnson and other progressive black figures also veered into claims that they weren't really black, say many PA supporters. Nana Asante Smith, chair of the PA PAC, says Durham has been treading dangerous territory in terms of questioning the blackness of our black leaders like Johnson based on notions that themselves are deeply rooted in white supremacy. That was the Durham O'Neill was elected to unify, one in which accusations of racism abounded as murder rates rose, income equality grew, and housing costs soared. After Shewell announced he wouldn't seek a third term, O'Neill swept into office with nearly 85% of the vote, facing only a last-minute challenge from Caballero, who suspended her campaign after the primary. Freeman, Middleton, and Williams all won DCABP endorsements, and only Middleton had also received the PA's support. Their ultimate victories were a clear statement that Durham voters wanted a change. Though much of the campaign focused on debates over moderate and progressive approaches to police reform, O'Neill's popularity had less to do with any policy position than with her relationships, particularly with the people who felt shut out by the progressive majority. Wagstaff says it's her history with the community that made people trust her. She's always been that type of person you can have confidence in. People knew her and trusted her, and that's what we wanted to see up there. After a scandal-plagued 2 years, the people who most wanted a change find themselves deeply disappointed. Bell says the black community in particular had high hopes in that leadership, given that you were electing the first African-American female mayor. And it turns out 6 of the 7 council people were African-American. I just think it was felt there was going to be more cordiality among the council members in terms of getting things done. At a minimum, people thought the mayor and the mayor pro tem would be on the same page. The disappointment does not mean O'Deal's backers blame her, however. One of the new divides in Durham policies is whom to blame for the divides on council. According to O'Neill's staunchest supporters, she and her allies Freeman and Hulsey Hyman were undermined and made to look weak and ineffective by an oppositional majority composed of the other 4. But the obvious fact is that a majority vote in an elected body is not a nefarious plot. It's the way democracy is supposed to work. The majority isn't a majority either. There are also divisions between progressives, such as Caballero and Johnson, and the moderates like Williams and Middleton. Johnson says the four of us who vote to approve housing developments do it for somewhat different reasons. It's not like a pro-business ethic that gets me there, where for other folks it might be. So what looks like a voting bloc is actually people coming together across difference. The allegations against Holsey-Hyman suggest that such political differences are only partial explanations, though. Simply, some council members just don't like each other. Most troublesome for DCABP activists and others who cheered the election returns in 21 is that the most vicious fights haven't been between moderates and progressives, but among the moderates. Freeman yelled at Middleton, after all, not Johnson. The explanations for the acrimony quickly devolve into conspiracy theories that wouldn't be worth considering if they weren't amplifying the hostility among elected officials. The theories range from mundane political ambition that Middleton hoped to be mayor, to baseless allegations of corruption that Williams is being paid by developers, to outlandish and convoluted setups that Middleton manufactured claims against Holsey-Hyman as punishment for not voting with him. The source for most of these theories, by her own admission, is Wagstaff. Quote, I believe Mark Anthony Middleton orchestrated this, she says. If he were standing here looking at me, I would tell him that. I'm not one of those people that's going to sit around and throw a rock and hide. An effective organizer with deep ties to various black communities across Durham, Wagstaff also has a history of controversy over her long political career, including being censured and suspended by DCABP in 2013 for being, quote, insubordinate, uncollaborative, and extremely impolite. But she remains a close and prominent ally of O'Neill, Freeman, and Holsey-Hyman. Middleton says it's just nonsense, and unfortunately some of it is being driven from the dais, which should be the paragon of sensibility and rationality and the chief brand ambassadors of our city. Middleton even wrote an email to his council colleagues in March alleging that one or more members of the city council shared a claim that meets the legal standard of slander with prominent members of the Durham community. If O'Neill, Freeman, and Holsey-Hyman have retained support, it's largely among those who believe the unflattering media reports and allegations are untrue. Instead, those supporters believe they are just another example of the long-running sexist and racist status quo. Smith, the East Durham activist and a Freeman ally, says, it bothers me that everyone's so quick to pathologize a black woman, but then they want to have Black Lives Matter signs in their yard, and then they want to say, trust black women. She says, there's a lot of people that know Deidreana in this community. We've never seen her hit or do that, so why did you believe that so quickly? Because the trope of the angry black woman. Freeman says, what folks try to label as toxic is the discomfort they feel when people challenge their racism, their sexism, all of those isms. Because Middleton in particular has grated on his political opponents, the response has found some purchase in parts of Durham. A dominant force on council, he received more votes in the 21 election than anyone else, Middleton is prone to long speeches and sharp rebukes, such as the 8-minute explanation he gave at that March 23rd work session of what a censure is and isn't, and the need for moral rectitude on council. Opponents have found such rhetoric more fitting for the church he pastors than for council chambers, and Freeman wasn't the first to call him a bully. Whitney Maxey, executive director of the progressive group Durham for All, and disclosure, the columnist was formerly a volunteer member leader with that group. Maxey says, there's that saying, everyone can't tell the same lie. Middleton, for his part, thinks he's just doing his job by asking pointed questions. And he says, some of those meetings where I've been accused of talking down or putting people on trial, I think that was due diligence. I think it would have been malpractice for me not to ask. with three divided blocks, allegations of federal crimes, and a populace growing desperate, the council was in clear need of a leader, someone who could unite the various factions or at least keep the conflict behind closed doors. O'Neill proved incapable of the task. Sources inside City Hall report that members from each block barely speak to the others outside of public meetings. While past mayors, Shewell and Bell, would act as facilitators for the everyday work of governing, O'Neill doesn't hold regular one-on-one meetings with most council members. Instead, she approaches the work the same way she approached her time as judge and law school dean, by trying to build community relationships. Other council members were left in the dark about key efforts like her attempt to negotiate a truce among gang members. Johnson says, "I have no idea. She did all that on her own." The approach allowed divisions to deepen and conflicts to fester. Then they'd explode into public view, like with a clear confusion over whether the council would censure Halsey Hyman, whether they were voting on the resolution at all, and who had approved the draft language. Or with this summer's surprise vote on additional raises for firefighters and police officers at the start of a heated budget meeting. That siloed, suspicious environment helps explain the quixotic quest against Wikipedia that O'Neill, Freeman, and Halsey Hyman launched to reveal who was adding unflattering details, or a simple signature in O'Neill's case, to their biographies. The broken trust is undeniable. Only Williams was able to maintain cordial relationships across all three council blocks for any length of time, often acting as the point of contact between them. Halsey Hyman even notes that he was the only council member to call her before the March 23rd work session, though she missed the call. Now, O'Neill is leaving office after a single term. The long-serving Johnson is leaving, too. Halsey Hyman is running to retain her council seat, but with an ongoing State Bureau of Investigation probe hanging over her. Freeman and Williams are rivals in the mayoral race, and whatever happens this fall, they'll still have to work together on the next council. In the midst of such chaos, all sides are relying more heavily on the network of people they already know. Who better to trust than the people you already work with, who talk like you, went to the same school you did, live in the same neighborhood? But the fundamental issue is that Durham's racial politics are undergoing a generational shift that such segregated networks can't manage. For decades, the city's two most influential political organizations, the Progressive, Historically White People's Alliance, and the Moderate Committee on the Affairs of Black People, negotiated political power along black, white, racial lines. Johnson explains in the old days they would meet up for fried chicken and decide who were going to be the city council members. Today, a cohort of younger activists, including black and Latino activists, are diversifying the PA and pushing it in even more progressive directions. But the PA still has prominent skeptics who believe the organization's many leaders of color are little more than figureheads. The membership, they believe, represents a subsection of Durhamites who are wealthier and whiter than the city as a whole. Freeman said it would be really nice to see them shift. Equity is more than tokenism. It's not just the loudest voice in the room. It should actually be something of substance. The identity politics era needs to go. For those PA leaders, though, such criticisms amount to complaints for those who didn't get their influential backing. Asante Smith, the PA PAC chair, says, "The reality is PA, supported statistically and with data, has truly evolved in its membership as it pertains to age, race, and engagement, to name a few characteristics." But even if the PA replaces a largely white old guard with a more diverse group of young members, it still represents a particular social group, as does the DCABP. Half the PA current leadership are alumni or employees of Duke, and only one has ties to NC Central. The ratios are nearly perfectly inverted in the committee's leadership, and working class people are often left out of both. Smith says the history of Black Durham is highly stratified by class, color, education, and by which family you came from. The tragedy of it all is that nearly every person involved in Durham politics agrees that nothing can be solved by Durham's government alone. No amount of power the PA or DCABP can gain will be enough to meet their agendas, which require organizing for state-level policies as well. And all the recent controversy, toxicity, and scandal risk a crisis of confidence that undermines effort to build towards larger political change. Johnson says, in an institution of public trust, maintaining that trust is the most important thing. If someone does something that violates it, regardless of who they are, a transparent and robust response is necessary, or you risk the integrity of the entire institution. After roughly 40 minutes of bickering, hectoring, and occasionally speaking to the issues at hand, O'Neill brought that March 23rd work session to a close. She said, "These are the people you elected, Durham, and it's up to you to hold everybody accountable. We should be ready for that, whatever that looks like. I don't know where Durham is poised and where it's going, but I hope that Durham City is paying attention to all of us." All right, we'll continue now with a sort of a general story, but from the State Division of Energy, Mineral, and Land Resources, just filed on August 15th, this story. Just 2 months into his job as director of that State Division of Mineral and Land Resources, Brian Wren faced one of the most contentious mining applications in recent state history. Details of his decision, issued 681 days after the application was filed, would reveal the pressure, chaos, and even rancor that was boiling over both publicly and within the agency. Now, a judge has found that DEMLR, which is under the NC Department of Environmental Quality, committed several key legal and procedural errors in denying Wake Stone's modified permit for the RDU quarry next to Umpsted State Park, prompting him, the judge, to reverse the agency's decision. After a contested case hearing requested by Wake Stone last year, Administrative Law Judge Donald Vandervaart, himself a former DEQ secretary, and a controversial one for his anti-regulatory stances, has ordered the state to grant the permit to Wake Stone within 30 days by September 12th, and also ordering DEQ to pay Wake Stone's attorney and witness fees, as well as other court-related costs. He wrote in a 53-page opinion, "It would be difficult to imagine a set of facts more demonstrative of an arbitrary and capricious government action." In April 2020, Wake Stone, which operates several quarries in North Carolina, applied for a modified mining permit to expand its triangle operation near Umpsted State Park to a nearby tract. Wake Stone had leased land from the RDU Airport Authority for a 106-acre rock quarry, 55 of them an open pit. Soon, DEMLR found itself wedged between the powerful Wake Stone, company president Sam Bratton would later be appointed by Governor Cooper as chairman of the Mining Commission, and the Umpsted Coalition, an active and influential community group opposed to the mine expansion. There were court challenges, some of them successful, regarding stream buffers and brought by the Umpsted Coalition. There were noise studies and bad math. DEMLR engaged with the same acoustic expert that had been hired by the Umpsted Coalition, leaving the agency vulnerable to charges of conflict of interest. State mining engineer David Miller, an agency veteran, miscalculated decibel levels in determining the noise impact. There were visual impact studies, although the word studies is generous. Miller tacked cardboard to some trees near where the land disturbance would occur and took photos with his cell phone, according to his court deposition. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, the evidence was mounting, no matter how distasteful to Wren or park supporters, that the proposed expansion, with tweaks here and there, would comply with the State Mining Act. That was written in 1971 by representatives of the corporate giant Martin Marietta, a DEQ lawyer said at a previous and unrelated court hearing. The agency can deny a permit based on any of seven criteria laid out in the law, but that's happened just four times, three of them since 2020. Over the last 50-plus years, the legislature has rarely amended the act, and then only in favor of the mining industry. Instead of requiring a mine to periodically renew its permits, for example, the permits are now life of site. That means unless there's a violation or modification, the mining company can obtain its permit and never look back. By early 2022, nearly 2 years after Wake Stone had filed that application, DEMLR had exhausted all its requests for additional information, and it was time to decide. Court documents show Wren, who had no mining experience and previously worked in the ecosystems branch before his promotion, was wedged between competing demands, and conflicts of Wake Stone with his own mining engineer, the public, and even other state agencies. The State Parks Division had written several letters to DEMLR opposing the mine, and Wren visited Umstead Park at its request. For his park, Miller said in his deposition that the Parks Division letters, quote, weren't worth the paper they were written on. Wren told DEQ leadership that a sound barrier wall would provide, quote, adequate visual screening, and that the truck traffic, quote, would not be expected to increase significantly as a result of the proposed expansion. Court documents showed that just 3 days before Wren denied the Wake Stone permit, he had edited the mining review, an internal document that logs changes and discussions, to recommend granting it. Yet when he denied the permit modification, he publicly cited traffic, noise, and visual impacts to Umstead Park. Wren acknowledges in court documents that there, quote, was quite a bit of internal documentation contradicting his decision to deny the application. However, Wren claimed that shortly before he announced his decision, he had asked Miller to revise the mining review to make it consistent with the denial. Miller, who, according to court documents, recommended granting the permit and told Wake Stone that it had good science on its side, did not do so. Even if Wren's decision had been legally watertight, it would have been moot. He didn't even have the legal authority to sign the permit, Van de Vaart ruled. However, it's unlikely Wake Stone would have challenged that lack of authority had the decision gone in its way. Under state law, DEQ Secretary, currently Elizabeth Beiser, can sign a permit or delegate that duty to any subordinate officer or employee of the department. Beiser recused herself from Wake Stone case because she used to lobby for parks and open space interests. She delegated the signing authority to Assistant DEQ Secretary Sushma Mazemore, but did not extend that authority to Wren. This is the second instance in the last year of DEQ losing a contested case, at least in part, of signing authority issues. In May, Administrative Law Judge John Evans, DEQ's former Chief Deputy Secretary under Van de Vaart, tossed a historic $260,000 fine against Bottomley Properties because the wrong DEQ employee signed the paperwork assessing the penalty. DEQ can appeal Van de Vaart's decision to Superior Court. However, as is common after a ruling, the agency has not commented on whether it will do so. Wren is no longer with the agency, according to the employee directory. He left DEMLR in December of 2022. Miller is still there. And this is a sort of extra to an article I read a couple of issues ago about the controversy, some almost violent controversy in the Orange County school system. But this is about Lee Williams, the chief equity officer for Orange County Schools. Shortly after he became that officer in 2022, Lee Williams was summoned to a tense meeting at an elementary school. A father had objected to an art project in which students had the option of coloring in their pronouns. Williams defended the project. The father turned to Williams. He recalls the man asking, "Are you a pedophile?" For those who have studied school districts embroiled in culture wars, this was a predictable encounter. According to a UCLA study published last year, equity officers across the country have reported being targeted by conservative groups as part of the growing backlash against anti-racist and LGBTQ-inclusive policies. Though not an entirely new tactic, the intensity has ramped up over the past 2 years because activists have made critical race theory a key talking point. Sometimes, the UCLA report says, a campaign against equity officers, especially officers of color, takes the form of explicit threats and intimidation. One father, Williams said, called him 19 times in a single day. "Do you think you're safe?" the parent asked. "Do you think your family's safe?" He's not sure. He tells his team to leave school board meetings together. He lifts weights to strengthen his body. He said, "I have reckoned with this idea. This is work I will die for." Williams knew he'd face hostility, though he didn't realize how much, when he left his job as a middle school principal in Guilford County to come to Orange. Shortly after his arrival last summer, Education Week published an article quoting his predecessor. She explained that she left Orange County Post because the blowback against critical race theory had made her job both ineffective and exhausting. This past May, Williams' office hosted a panel discussion for LGBTQ school system employees and their allies called Pride in the Profession. It was open to the public, but there were enough safety and confidentiality concerns that organizers decided not to record it. Gretchen Schmidt, the local Moms for Liberty chapter chair, was there. The event poster had welcomed both LGBTQ people and their, quote, co-conspirators, a word that caught her eye. "If you've been labeled a conspirator in our country the last 3 years," she said, "the FBI is hunting you down." Panelists shared their personal stories and discussed age-appropriate ways to support queer kids and educate all students. They discussed a Pride Month slide deck for elementary classrooms, and they shared their fears about North Carolina's Senate Bill 49, a Republican-sponsored Parents' Bill of Rights that Governor Cooper later vetoed. The bill would require schools to notify parents when their children adopt new pronouns. Panelist Billy Markham, a fifth-grade teacher, remembered saying, "A lot of teachers have already said they're not comfortable throwing their kids under the bus." Afterward, Markham said, audience members lined up to thank her. She felt so supported, she said, that later she used the phrase, "my wife," in her classroom for the first time in 26 years. She said it got zero reaction from my students. Schmidt viewed the event differently. She bristled at the mention of the slide deck, believing that its message of inclusion and allyship masked a pro-transgender indoctrination campaign, and she disliked when Williams asked the audience not to debate panelists. Basically, she said, this was like a communist meeting. Barred from recording, Schmidt took detailed notes instead and reported them through email and social media. Word spread from there. Jackie Barker, the parent who challenged the Cedar Ridge High School library books, wrote to elected officials, "The district is using celebrities and children's picture books to brand LGBTQ by instilling thoughts into undeveloped children's minds that they too can switch genders." One of the ones she wrote to was SB 49's co-sponsor, Alamance County Republican State Senator Amy Gailey. She, in turn, wrote to Superintendent Monique Felder, asking about plans to disobey the law if it passes. Felder replied, "Orange County Schools complies with all federal, state, and local laws." Gailey also requested Orange Elementary School curriculum and teaching materials related to sexuality and gender identity. The right-wing journalist A.P. Dillon wrote to the district requesting Markham's employment details, including her salary. And at the next regular board meeting, a Moms for Liberty member without kids in the system publicly named Markham and another panelist. Williams knows that some colleagues are uncomfortable in the spotlight, but he also believes that change is birthed from discomfort. And he says, there's no more hiding in fear in the shadows. I'm right here. I come in every day, head held high, on a swivel, still wanting to make it home every day, but also knowing this is the right work for me. Returning now to the Durham area, people interested in documentary films, the Full Frame Festival is to return to downtown Durham, writes Sarah Edwards. They announced yesterday morning the event will go April 4 through 7 in 2024. Emily Foster, co-director of the festival, says by the time we get to 2024, it'll have been 5 years since we last held an in-person festival. Returning to the physical landscape is a big milestone for Durham and the documentary community. The celebrated festival was held virtually between 20 and 22 during the pandemic. It was unexpectedly put on pause this past spring amid upheaval at Duke's Center for Documentary Studies. The Documentary Arts Center has organized the event since 1998. This year, it will produce the festival in partnership with Duke Venue and Production Management, VPM, the events and operations branch of the university. Foster, Emily Foster, will co-direct that festival alongside longtime director Sadie Tillery, who had stepped down from her role earlier this year but agreed to come back. Tillery wrote to the Indy, I believe in Full Frame. With Duke University's support at the festival and the new partnership between the CDS and VPM, I'm confident in Full Frame's return in 2024. News of the revival comes just a day after Duke leadership sent an email to CDS faculty and staff announcing that Director Opiyemi Olukimi had submitted her resignation and the Duke had accepted it. Ed Balason, Duke's Vice Provost for Interdisciplinary Studies, is temporarily filling the role of the center's director. Olukemi, who previously served as the Senior Director of Interactive Programs at Tribeca Film Institute, had come on staff at CDS in September 2021, a fraught time to begin a leadership role at any institution, to be sure. But as the Assembly reported earlier this year, her tenure quickly became unusually fraught as the center staff shrunk from 45 to 15, and the bulk of programs, including the festival, were put on an indefinite hiatus against the backdrop of an eight-figure quasi-endowment. Following the Assembly's reporting, CDS leadership held a meeting in March at which Olukemi outlined what she described as a budget crisis that, according to her, predated her tenure and required a dramatic institutional overhaul, as well as a shift from the documentary arts to applicable media. At that meeting, seven staff members were laid off, and one, Sadie Tillery, who had served as festival director since 2008, resigned. This broad slate of changes alarmed many CDS faculty and alumni, who worried that the future of CDS hung in the balance and that Full Frame might end entirely. In late March, a petition in support of the festival circulated, accruing over 1,600 signatures. The petition read, "We worry that layoffs of Full Frame staff and the possibility of further resignations will cause so much institutional knowledge to be lost, it soon will be impossible to revive the festival. We hope that Duke and the leadership at the Center for Documentary Studies will take to heart their role as stewards of this important and unique festival and will work aggressively to get it back on track for next year." This upheaval has occurred alongside the restructuring of other Duke institutions. In August, John Brown, Vice Provost for the Arts, announced that Duke Performances was rebranding as Duke Arts Presents, a subset of Duke Arts going forward. Brown said in a letter posted to the Duke Arts website, "This new identity will better align our current programs, operations, and initiatives with the academic mission of the university." The organization has seen a number of staff exits since Brown's appointment, but the letter did not contain specifics about the reason for the massive rebranding. The festival's 2024 presence will mean an uptick in downtown foot traffic, which has suffered not only since the start of the pandemic, but since other local festivals like Art of Cool and Moog Fest have dried up or moved on. Discover Durham CEO Susan Amy says of Full Frame, "It's part of the bones of Durham. Festivals are part of the quality of life of any city, and this one has always been one of the major festivals in Durham. Frankly, festivals have been slow to return after the pandemic, so we could not be more pleased." Tillery told Indy, said, "I am proud of the documentaries Full Frame has screened online in recent years, but nothing compares to seeing a film illuminate the darkness of a crowded movie theater." She added that organizers are working with VPM to address the staffing deficit. Quote, "We always seek to highlight space between the movies and the people watching them and to foster a great festival-going experience. I'm excited to shape opportunities for dialogue and a meaningful exchange in downtown Durham." Full Frame is the biggest community-facing program of CDS, so its return doesn't answer every lingering question about the future of the documentary program. And the festival's footprint has also quietly downsized. For example, Full Frame no longer has a lease at the American Tobacco campus. Nevertheless, that return is an overwhelmingly welcome one. Full Frame, an Oscar-qualifying event, has regularly drawn tens of thousands of documentary lovers from across the globe, marking Durham as a space for the documentary and experimental arts. In one Durham neighborhood, neighbors have taken to holding Frame Half Full, a series of backyard documentary screenings in recent years. The series began during the pandemic, the brainchild of residents Kathy Saylor and Mark Maximoff, a former CDS staffer, but continued on, filling a full frame-shaped hole in the hearts of local documentary lovers. Recent screenings have included The Truffle Hunters and The Melt Goes On Forever. Florence Nash, who hosts the Frame Half Full screenings, says, "I'm just delighted it's back. Durham has such a banquet of cultural resources. We've got Full Frame. We've got the American Dance Festival. We've got all these writers and artists." Well, let's talk about one of those other festivals, the American Dance Festival, and that is starting very soon. It actually is going on right now. On August the 22nd is the final day. Now, this article is called Chaos Theory, written by Lauren Wickenroth from IndieWeek. If you've seen a dance film in the state of North Carolina, odds are that Kara Hagen had something to do with it. A prolific dance filmmaker herself and the former longtime director of the American Dance Festival's Movies by Movers, Hagen has long shaped the North Carolina dance scene with her thoughtfully curated dance film festival programs and her own fascinating films. Plus, she recently literally wrote the book on screen dance with her 2022 Screen Dance from Film to Festival. You could see the medium of dance film as a relatively controlled setting. Without the unknowns of a live performance, audiences sit in their seats and generally see what the filmmaker wants them to see. Hagen's latest work, Were We Birds?, a site-specific live dance piece at the Nasher Museum of Art, which closes out this year's ADF on the 22nd, pivots firmly in the opposite direction, handing the reins back over to audiences and allowing them to shape their own experience of the work, from where they choose to watch it to the music they choose or not to listen to. For Hagen, who is now based in New Jersey while teaching at the New School in New York City, giving audiences the agency to choose, quote, echoes the choices we need to make as human beings in these chaotic situations, Do I go over here or over here? Do I listen now or do I choose not to listen? What is my role in all of this chaos, and how much of a choice do I really have? By all of this chaos, Hagen means the COVID pandemic and everything that's come with it. Her own chaotic pandemic experience. She was apart from her husband for a year, moved 3 times with a small child, and had an international job opportunity fall through. Partly inspired Were We Birds, which explores migration and displacement, upheaval and reorganization. She says, I began thinking of all the ways that people are displaced, not just because of COVID, but I think COVID brought to light a lot of ways that people are disenfranchised and the ways we don't make space for the chaos in people's lives. We live in a society where we just have to keep going like everything's fine. We're moving, we're shaking, we're doing what we've got to do. And meanwhile, everybody's having these huge experiences in their lives that we're just glazing over. Were We Birds, which was commissioned by ADF, is arguably Hagen's largest scale presentation in this state after she spent many years here on faculty at Appalachian State and High Point University, where she created the dance program. For Hagen, though, that framing is complex, as she has long orchestrated screen dance projects of equal or larger scale, but in the sometimes forgotten role as curator. She says, curating is such an invisible kind of work. People see the thing you put together, but they don't necessarily equate you with it. But in Were We Birds, Hagen will be highly visible, both as the piece's author and as one of its 3 performers, alongside fellow NC School of the Arts alumni Laura Gutierrez and Tammy Carrasco, who will be up close and personal with audiences as they wander through the Nasher's lobby, observing from whatever vantage point they choose. Audiences will also be in charge of using their own devices to scan QR codes throughout the museum to access the music, a dreamy original jazz score by composer Amanda Adelman via headphones. She says, this was particularly a logistical choice. She says, the Nasher is sonically really challenging. We want people to hear this beautiful music. How can we do that and make sure everyone is having the experience they want to have? But since audiences will be able to decide when to start and stop the music or whether to watch in silence, they'll inevitably end up on a journey that is entirely their own. Higgins, who is not rehearsing to the music, says, I'm interested in how people will see the same sections to very different music and how that will change their perception of what they're seeing. The way each audience member interprets the piece will be very different, depending on where they choose to stand, what they choose to listen to, who's around them, and how they're navigating past other people. The ADF premiere will be something of a test run for Were We Birds, which Hagen hopes to someday tour to spaces like train stations, where performers and audiences must navigate not only one another, but masses of other bodies coming and going. It'll be an added layer of chaos, and one that Hagen will welcome. She asks, how do you reconcile chaos and create some sort of order, only to know that there's chaos on the horizon at some other point? We never actually get out of it. And to close this article again, Were We Birds is at the Nasher Museum of Art, Tuesday, August 22nd at 7 and 9 p.m. nasher.duke.edu. And the ticket price quoted here, $16. And now for possibly the last article I'll only be able to read in part, an article about Derek Beasley in conversation with Pierce Freelon. And this is about surviving the burn. And it relates to performances at the North Star Church of the Arts in Durham, which began last Friday and goes on to Friday, September 15th. And Swamp Jam on August 18th, coming right up at 6 p.m. at North Star Church of the Arts. And the introduction begins, "Everyone in Durham has personal lore. The story of who we are and how we came to be. And if you do the work of being present enough to make your mark on the community, your lore becomes part of the fabric of the city. When I think of the artist Derek Beasley, I think about an architect of black abundance, cultural memory, and placemaking," writes the columnist Marcella Camara. "Once an administrator at community education organization Student U, now a full-time artist and member of the city's Open Space and Trails Committee, Beasley's work has taken many shapes throughout the years. Depending on who you ask, his legend takes many forms, from his time at Riverside High and AT&T, to his work with Black August in the Park and Tall Grass Food Box. Like many unsung members of this community, though, the moments that shaped his identity, creative output, and place as an architect of this city have gone unexplored in our community's signature public media and archives." Surviving the Burn, Beasley's upcoming solo exhibition and residency at North Star Church of the Arts, begins August 11th and runs through September 15. Through self-portraiture, sculpture, and installation, this show explores apocalyptic notions of environmental collapse, nature, masculinity, community, and black identity. Embarking on Surviving the Burn allowed Beasley to join hands with community members who parallel his role as an important piece of the tapestry of his hometown. Arts advocate and producer Myra Wise of Proxemic Media worked alongside Beasley to develop and curate this exhibition. Photographers Kennedy Carter and Cornell Watson turned their lenses on Beasley for a rare opportunity for him to be the subject, and I had the honor of reflecting on Derek's legacy while helping curate program for this exhibition. It coincides with several community events, including Swamp Jam, a block party in celebration of Surviving the Burn. Ahead of the show, Pierce Freelon sat down with Beasley to discuss growing up and making art and community in a gentrifying Durham. And I'll have to bring that to a close as Rodeo Rodney includes to wrangle us off to our feed bins. And I await my bag of oats, my nose bag of oats. They're delicious. And we hope to be with you next week, John Federson, for the Indie Week. And we say so long now, partners.